From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Boogie Nights is now out on video. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear from the film's director and screenwriter, Paul Thomas Anderson. The film won Burt Reynolds an Academy Award nomination for his portrayal of a porn movie director who wants his films to have plots and action, not just sex. Also, Twitch and Shout. Lowell Handler talks about living with Tourette's syndrome. His memoir has just been published. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews cornetist Olu Dara's debut album as a leader, which also shows off his singing and blues guitar playing. And film critic John Powers reviews The Truman Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United Auto Workers Union has called a strike at a key General Motors stamping plant in Flint, Michigan. It makes body parts for some GM full-sized light trucks and cars. NPR's Don Gagne reports live from Flint.
Members of United Auto Workers Local 659 say the company has broken a promise to invest millions of dollars into their plant and to commit new production work here. They have walked off the job. If this strike at the GM metal fabricating facility in Flint lasts long, it could have a significant impact on the automaker's U.S. production. Some plants which rely on this one for parts could start closing down early next week. The strike also threatens to disrupt the launch of GM's newest pickup truck, an important product that analysts say GM really needs. Talks right now are scheduled to resume Monday. Corva?
Don, what's the one issue that has the union membership so angry?
You know, over the Memorial Day weekend, when all of the workers were off for the holiday, the company, at a time when the talks weren't going that well, started to move some machinery and some dies out of the plant, kind of a hedge in case they wanted to set it up somewhere else to continue to produce the parts built here. The workers were really angered when they saw that. I've covered a lot of strikes, and today the level of bitterness over the moving of those dies is as high as I have ever seen it in a situation like this.
NPR's Don Gagne reporting live from Flint, Michigan. Utah police believe they have trapped two suspects in a desert canyon wanted in the murder of a police officer. A third suspect was discovered dead earlier. He reportedly shot himself. The men are suspected of shooting the Colorado policeman to death 1 week ago. Authorities have evacuated an artist's colony near the canyon and cleared rafters from the nearby San Juan River. An early morning computer glitch caused major delays at all three major New York City airports this morning. Carrie Nolan of member station WNYC reports.
Technicians were loading a new software program into the Terminal Radar Approach Control, or TRACON, system at a control center on Long Island when the glitch occurred. The result was early morning delays of up to 2 hours on flights in and out of Kennedy, LaGuardia, and Newark airports, as well as at several smaller area airports. TRACON controls flights within a 60-mile radius of airports and their towers. A spokesman for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which runs the airports, said that after the glitch occurred, technicians were able to reload the old software. He also said that the ripple effect caused by the glitch would not be as extensive as it could have been because it happened before the airport's morning rush. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 80 points at 89.50. The Nasdaq is up more than 9 at 17.79. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stocks open higher today with a new economic report that showed strong jobs growth. But there's a major labor action taking place against the country's biggest car company. NPR's Jack Spear has more.
The news that more Americans were working in May than at any time in the past 28 years came out before the start of trading today. Labor Department reported the economy created 296,000 new non-farm jobs last month. Unemployment held steady at 4.3%. While such strong numbers usually cause concern for the financial markets, prompting fears of further interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve Board, that does not appear to be the case today. Also moving the market, word of that strike by General Motors workers at a Michigan parts plant. GM stock is down slightly. Stock in Motorola, which announced after the market had closed yesterday it will cut 15,000 jobs, is up slightly today. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Labor problems in France are starting to pinch the country just as it gears up for the World Cup soccer tournament. Air France pilots are in their fifth day of striking. The pilots are upset over proposed wage cuts, and they say they will stay out for another 15 days past the start of World Cup play. Airport baggage handlers are observing the pilots' picket lines, and airline mechanics say they'll go out this weekend. Meanwhile, French railway conductors are off the job through at least tomorrow in their pay dispute. That has reduced the number of rail operations. Russian President Boris Yeltsin is ready to make a deal with fellow citizens. He's promising he won't let Russia's financial crisis trigger inflation. But he is asking that Russians in return pay all their taxes. He's warning them if they don't, there could be a return to Soviet-style ration cards and long lines in stores. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
My name is Jack.
Eddie Adams.
Eddie Adams from Torrance.
Yep.
Jack Warner, filmmaker.
Really?
Yeah. I make adult films, exotic pictures.
That's Burt Reynolds and Mark Wahlberg in a scene from Boogie Nights. It's now out on video, so on this archive edition, we're featuring an interview with the film's writer and director, Paul Thomas Anderson. His screenplay, and co-stars Burt Reynolds and Julianne Moore, received Academy Award nominations. Boogie Nights is about a group of people who make porn films. Reynolds plays a director who's slightly more ambitious than the average X-rated director. He aspires to make movies that people will watch for the story as well as the sex. Mark Wahlberg plays the well-endowed teenager who, with the help of the director, becomes one of the biggest stars of adult films. Boogie Nights takes place from 1977 to 84 and chronicles how the business was turned upside down by cocaine and video. Although filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson is only in his late 20s, Boogie Nights is his second feature film. His first, Hard Eight, was set in the world of casino gambling. Before we get to the interview, let me tell you that some of our discussion was about adult subject matter. Anderson told me that he grew up in the San Fernando Valley, which he describes as the capital of the adult film business. I asked him if, as part of his research, he ever went to the set of an adult film.
I went after I'd written the first draft and spent some time and hung around and just, it's a trip, you know. For the first 10 seconds, it's kind of shocking, but then after those 10 seconds, the shock sort of goes away and it's just work, you know, and you're kind of witnessing these people really trying to do good work, you know, and it's really not that different from a real film set, you know, where they're worried about the same things, like, okay, is it in focus? Is the lighting okay? You know,
how's my hair?
You know, are we communicating what we want to communicate here? You know, and that's, kind of interesting and wonderful, I think.
Boy, if you ever needed a metaphor to kind of hammer home film as voyeurism, being right on a porn set would have to be it.
Yes.
Now, you got Burt Reynolds to be in this movie, and it's an excellent performance, and everybody is saying so. He was a big film star in the 70s when this movie mm-hmm. is set. You grew up in the 70s. Did he mean much to you when you were growing up?
Yeah, he did. I mean, I can remember, you know, being, and I told him this, I said when I was 8 years old and I saw Hooper, the first thing I did was go home and sort of recreate the title sequence of Hooper, you know, in my own bedroom, like with like soccer pads, you know. I mean, the opening title sequence of Hooper, he's like putting on all these stuntmen pads, and I would sort of ran home to my bedroom and sort of recreated that title sequence with, and I told him, and I he was impressed, I think.
Was that
think
a good enough credential? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why he's in the movie.
Well, was it hard to get him to be in it? I mean, this is your second film, second feature-length film to be released, but he probably didn't know you from a hole in the wall when you approached him.
He didn't, but, you know, the first time I met him was right after, so I sort of set up a screening of my first movie for him, and he watched it, and he had read Boogie Nights, so he knew what he was getting into, and we sat down, and it was kind of wonderful. And it was sort of the same thing as going to a porno set. You know, for the first 10 seconds, it's Burt Reynolds. Oh, my God, you know. But then it sort of quickly went away, and it was just an interesting guy to talk to. And that's kind of the way it was on the set, you know, is that ultimately it's just he's just another actor who just wants to do good work, you know. And it's but that's not to say that there weren't a couple times where while we were editing the movie, it was actually – you know, he would turn his head in a certain way or the light would catch him in a certain way, and I'd just sort of stop and say, that's Burt Reynolds. How did Burt Reynolds get in this movie? What's happening here?
Paul Thomas Anderson is my guest, and he wrote and directed the new film Boogie Nights. The Burt Reynolds character in your movie is a porn producer and director who wants to make movies that incorporate story into them, so people won't just watch the movie to see the sex scenes. They'll want to see what the outcome of the story is.
Right.
Is that based on a certain character or a certain type of trend in 70s porn?
Absolutely. That's something that you saw, I think, in 70s porn was more of an effort to create a genre, you know, to create a whole new sort of set of rules for these, you know, to take it out of sort of stag film status and make it, you know, a genre where you could tell a story and also have a movie that was basically a sex film. So I think Burt's character is kind of based on a lot of notions that flew around at that time, and there was a lot of people that really wanted to kind of try and dignify the industry at that time. Not to mention that Burt can also accurately reflect, I think, any so-called legitimate filmmaker's wishes, you know, which is, how do I make a good movie where, you know, I can keep people in the theater?
You obviously have a real affection for some of these characters. Did you know any of the people in the pornography industry, or have you since come to know them through the making of this movie?
I've since come to know them through the making of the movie. It's funny because when I first wrote the movie, I'd never been to a real porn set. Like I said, I'd only been sort of surrounded by it in a peripheral way, and all of my sort of knowledge was based on just sort of watching porno movies and seeing documentaries or reading a couple articles. And the actual research sort of in the field that I did was just to verify, well, is what I think the truth, you know. And then when I did meet some of the people in the industry, I kind of saw that my imagination wasn't really too far off from what the truth was. Well, actually, I should correct that. I would say that it was funnier and sadder than I thought it was going to be.
The young porn star in your movie is played by Mark Wahlberg. And in the movie, you know, his name is Eddie in the film, but he takes on the porn name Dirk Diggler. That's a name he imagines, you know, a porn star should have. How did you come up with that name, Dirk Diggler?
I have no idea, but I know that I still have the index card that where I wrote that name down when I was 17 years old in my bedroom. I really don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I think a good porn name has to have two G's in it.
Oh, that's I knew that, important. Yeah. It's a kind of common assumption. Why? Why two G's?
I don't know. It just looks good and it sounds good for a good porn name. And you know, a K is pretty important, too. So, you know, I wish I really knew. But it just kind of hit me like it hit him, I guess, like Dirk Diggler. Wow. That's my future.
There's a scene where Dirk Diggler pulls down his pants for the first time, and the crew of the porn movie sees how well endowed he is. Mm-hmm. And the camera pans the expression on each of their faces, and everybody has this absolutely fantastic look on their face.
Right.
And I'm wondering what the actors were really looking at when you shot those expressions.
You know, that's a wonderful question, and the answer is me. honestly, I think, and I remember it was the sound guy who said that was probably his single greatest experience on a film set, and I don't know what language I can use on the air, but I sat just off camera, because Mark and Julianne, you know, we weren't needed, they were just off camera. I sat off camera, and I said, okay, just look at me, and each reaction followed, as you see in the movie.
Well, you must have really showed them something to get those expressions. That's very
You know,
funny.
I'm a method director, you know, I really.
The casting in your movie is really terrific. I mean, we've talked about Burt Reynolds, and Mark Wahlberg is very good. Julianne Moore, an actress I love, is just wonderful in the role of a porn star who's married to the director played by Burt Reynolds. And W.H. Macy plays an assistant director. Ricky Jay, the sleight-of-hand artist, you know, plays the cameraman. John C. Reilly, who had the starring role in your previous film, Heart 8, co-stars in this. He's terrific. What a find. I mean, do you have an approach to casting that you'd want to talk about? I just think you have a great eye for really good actors.
Yeah. Well, there's two approaches. First is most of those actors that you just mentioned are friends of mine.
Oh.
So I, and it's wonderful because I get to write parts for them. A, because they're my favorite actors. B, because they're my friends and we get to spend all summer shooting a movie together, you know. So it's just wonderful. And John Reilly and Phil Hoffman, Philip Baker Hall were all in my first movie. And it's a leg up, you know, to be able to go to an actor and say, well, what kind of part haven't you played before? What do you want to do in this one? And what can I write for you that you know would really thrill you? And that's kind of fun. And you can also sort of factor in wonderful personal things about them that, you know, no one else knows, you know, and you can kind of write it in. And the wonderful thing is when they say, this character is nothing like me, and you kind of go, sure it's not, you know. But anyway, and then, you know, with someone like Ricky Jay, there's a great advantage to, you know, going to make a movie is that you get to kind of meet people that you really want to meet. And for a long time, I wanted to meet Ricky Jay, and this was a way to meet him, to send him the script and go, I want you to be in this movie. Please, can I just hang out with you? Can I just be around you? and he said, okay. You know, with casting, it's funny because, you know, you mentioned Julianne Moore. I mean, she is someone that I had in mind when I wrote the part, but I didn't know her personally, you know. I knew her work. And so I wrote the part with her in mind and gave her the script and she went with it. I have a great casting director named Christine Sheeks, who really has wonderful instincts. She also cast my first movie. And not just in terms of these bigger parts, you know, but in terms of the smaller parts, you know, and the thing you always look over is the person that says, you know, that comes on and says, like, more coffee, you know. You always kind of can look those over. And it's fun to... there are so many great actors out there. There really are. There are so many great actors that I really loved making a movie where there's 80 parts. You know, I mean, there's about 80 parts in this movie, and I got to cast 80 actors. And I just love watching them act, you know.
My guest is Paul Thomas Anderson, the screenwriter and director of Boogie Nights. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're listening back to an interview with director and screenwriter Paul Thomas Anderson. His film Boogie Nights is now out on video. Boogie Nights has an R rating, but
yeah.
It was originally, I think, an NC-17.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide to tone it down?
Well, that's a contractual thing. You know, when I first went to try and get money for this movie, I sat down with New Line and I said, so here's the deal. It's 3 hours long and it's going to be NC-17. And they said, can you pick one? And I said, okay, I'll pick one. I'll take it as a challenge to make this an R-rated movie, but it's going to be long, you know. Are you okay with that? And they said, fine. So contractually, you know, I was obligated to make an R. On our first submission, the film wasn't NC-17. You know, it had... no scene was taken out of the movie to get the R, but it was just a matter of sort of negotiating and trimming down on some of the sex in the first sex scene that you see between Julianne and Mark. Just some of the shots were extended a bit more, so, you know, I don't know how how graphic I can be here, but it basically was just shots of humping, you know, Mark on top of Julianne humping, and you see, if you see his bare ass, and they're just sort of humping, if that goes on too long, that's something they say is a no-no. So you deal with the MPAA, and you kind of negotiate back and forth about what you can get away with and what you can't, and at the end of the day, I'm really happy with where the movie is. You know, I think none of the stuff that they suggested changing was stuff that affected the story, you know, and that was sort of the line that I had to draw was, well, you know, if we're just talking about shots of Mark's butt, you know, that's one thing, but the second this any of these suggestions affect the storytelling of the movie, we're going to have a problem. And it never did, you know, it never got there. And the funny thing is that I went back, I was going to do an unrated version for overseas or for Laserdisc, and I looked at it, and it's like 40 seconds worth of stuff, and I said, well, this is just silly, and I don't need it, and this is really the best version of the movie.
There's a scene where the Mark Wahlberg character comes home, and you could tell he's aroused by the bulge in his pants. Does that count as something that they wanted? Did you have to negotiate that with the board?
No, that wasn't one. They didn't have a problem with that. They had a problem with, like I said, humping, for how long humping goes on. They had a problem with humping and talking at the same time. And essentially it boiled down to when they said, so she's humping there and she's talking. Can you pick one? And I said, well, the talking is more important. So we just went and shot a shot of Nina Hartley. And I said, Nina, hump once, stop, say your lines, and we'll move on. And we did that and put it in and got the R.
Well, that sounds like a bad joke about not being able to chew gum and walk a straight line at the same time, doesn't it?
Yes. It's a similar thing.
Paul Thomas Anderson is my guest, director and writer of the new film Boogie Nights, and his earlier film is called Hard Eight. There's some great disco through the movie. I'm wondering what your feelings for that music is.
Well, I love all the music in the movie. It's sort of music that comes from my record collection, you know. The criterion for picking the music was it just has to be cool, you know? And that was really the first thing. You know, it's nice if on the other hand, it can work kind of thematically, or maybe lyrically there's something that happens that kind of complements what's happening in the movie. That can always be nice, you know? But just sort of music should just work on the vibe level first, you know? That's sort of the criterion that we used. And I'm very fond of that music.
The opening scene in your movie has behind it The Best of My Love by
right.
The Emotions. It's really, I mean, that record has to really help set the energy level for the movie. So it must have been really hard to narrow down, of all the records you could use, which one are you going to choose? How did you choose it?
You know what? That was not a tough choice. That, though, to me, there was only two songs sort of as choice for the opening, and it was either Best of My Love or Got to Be Real. And then Carlito's Way came out, and I saw that Got to Be Real was used pretty prominently, so it was very clear to me that The Emotions was the winner, you know. But I love that song. I think I love not only the sort of the lyrical value of the song, but just, like I said, the vibe of the song and the way that it starts to start, you know, in punctuation with the title coming on. It was really great.
Your movie is set in the 70s and early 80s. So, you know, part of the movie, you're really dealing with 70s fashions and 70s looks, whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, the stud look or the country and western dude look. My friend likes to call the 70s the decade that fashion forgot. It's the decade you came of age, and I figure when you were growing up, you thought that everybody always wore, you know, big hair and big sideburns and big collars and things
right,
like
right,
that.
Right.
Did you have fun with the clothes in the movie?
I did. You know, I have to say the funny thing is that for as much focus as there is on the 70s stuff, I had more fun with the 80s stuff. I mean, because that was just a clearer kind of memory to me, is sort of moving into my adolescence and, you know, the sort of the wonderful trend of headbands and capizios and, you know, lots of zippers on everything, you know. Was actually incredibly fun. The 70s stuff was great, you know, and the funny thing was is that my costume designer, Mark Bridges, actually, we had a hard time finding some of the stuff because, you know, the thrift stores are sort of bare, you know, I mean, 70s fashions are so in vogue now that, that it, the thrift stores are sort of all out of this stuff. So we really had to, it was sort of a massive, a much bigger treasure hunt than you might think to find some of these clothes. But the 80s clothes weren't hard to find. There's certainly a lot of headbands and and leg warmers out there.
Unwanted.
That's right.
Paul Thomas Anderson is my guest, writer and director of the new film Boogie Nights, about the pornography film industry from the mid-70s to the mid-80s. His previous film was called Hard Eight. Your first film, Hard Eight, was set primarily in Las Vegas, where, without saying too much about the story, a young guy in his 20s who's really kind of lost finds a father figure who's this kind of expert gambler and mm-hmm. is showing him the ropes in Vegas, showing him the little tricks to get a free room, tricks to make people think that you're a real, like, high-stakes roller and a real winner and all of that. And I'm wondering how much you knew about Vegas when making that movie. About gambling, too.
I knew a lot. I'd spent a lot of time gambling, and I still like to gamble. I spent a lot of time in Vegas, and I really was just kind of in a time where I was obsessing about gambling. And I think in the same way I made a movie about the Valley, because I just wanted to stay in the Valley because that's where I lived at the time, I wanted to be able to walk to location. I made a movie in Reno just because I wanted to go gamble. You know, I really wanted to be there.
Why did you want to gamble?
I wanted to make money.
Did you make any?
No.
Did you lose a lot?
I lost a ton. You know, but
you know, I've said this before, but I can never understand why anybody who knows movies gambles, because in every gambling movie, the gambler always loses big in the end and destroys his life and mm-hmm. destroys his family. So, I mean, you always know what the outcome is going to be.
Exactly. But, you know, I think that's why you're there, is spending a year of your life trying to figure out why the hell am I doing this, you know, and hopefully you can get some answers from it.
Paul Thomas Anderson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me and asking good questions.
Paul Thomas Anderson recorded last year. He wrote and directed Boogie Nights, which is now out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Rain shower.
Rain. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the CD we're listening to now by cornetist Olu Dara, who also sings and plays guitar. Lowell Handler discusses living with Tourette's syndrome, the subject of his new memoir, Twitch and Shout. And John Powers reviews the new film, The Truman Show.
Dead flower. Dead flower. Washed up in the mud, upside a tree, right here next to me.
so slippery. I just can't get home, baby. But I'm gonna be sliding home in the mud to you. Sliding home in the mud to you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Olu Dara is an elusive figure on the New York jazz scene, a cornetist who played with drummer Art Blakey in the early 70s. Then he became a key ally of new jazz composer saxophonists Julius Hempel, David Murray, and Henry Threadgill. All of them made excellent use of Dara's pungent blues style. Dara usually keeps a low profile and only now has a CD of his own, his first ever. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Dara's debut is not so jazzy, but you can't fairly accuse him of selling out.
Olu Dara on cornet, the trumpet's stubbier cousin, which has a quieter, more conversational tone that fits him perfectly. On his new CD from the Atlantic label, called In the World, From Natchez to New York, Dara plays some lovely cornet, but not much of it. As on his two rare live appearances, he's more inclined to sing a few songs and play some blues guitar. But I expect many fans of his jazz work will have the same reaction to his CD that I had the first time I saw him perform. He doesn't do what you expect, but he does what he does so well, you don't care.
Young mama, young mama. Just need a little time, maybe a new fella to talk about what's on your mind.
Olu Dara comes from Natchez, Mississippi, and spent time in the Navy during which he visited the Caribbean and Africa. In the 60s, he settled in New York, where he played rhythm and blues for a while. When jazz musicians started hiring him, he was glad for the work, but he still felt and sounded like a blues musician. Dara is not one to deny his roots. On his big label CD, he doesn't surround himself with famous friends, but sticks with his working band of lesser-known players. In the World isn't really a jazz record, but it does shed light on where jazz comes from. For instance, Dara illuminates the connections between black Southern speech and the rhythms and inflections of jazz music. His tune, Okra, is an homage to street vendors back home.
I got strawberry, strawberry. I got fresh peas. I got good-looking ears of corn. I got the homemade drink.
Mississippi, Africa, the Caribbean, New York, you can find all of Olu Dara's ports of call in there. As with another great entertainer, Louis Armstrong, you can hear his singing and playing as mirror images of one another. Like Armstrong, Olu Dara has the gift. He's as natural an entertainer and blues musician as anyone around. But like any good blues man, he knows life has its grim side, too. The track Jungle Jay features Dara's more famous son, the big-selling rapper Nas.
jungle.
You have to look out everywhere I go, have to turn around. Watch my back, jungle. Watch my front. That's what it's all about. It's the jungle of the mind. It's a jungle when you hang where they bang. The world's so big yet so small, it's one block. Many die mentally before they reach what they wanted. I choose to get blunted and cruise to 125th Street. Music loud as hell in my Jeep. Eyes meet people, strangers, not thinking of danger amongst my people.
On his new CD, Oludara traces the arc of the African-American cultural diaspora, from country picnics to the urban pressure cooker. He makes us hear how it's all connected, blues to hip-hop, West Africa to the West Indies to West 125th Street, makes us hear it when others only talk about it. His music is so deft and charming, you forgive him for not showing off his cornet playing, even if you wish he'd feature it a bit more on his next CD, whenever he gets around to that.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed In the World, From Natchez to New York, by Oludara. Kevin's new book, New Dutch Swing, has just been published. He'll talk with us about it soon.
Zora, I'm so sad. Zora, I heard they ran you out of Harlem. I feel so sad. I heard you cleaning for a man who owns a paper mill. Mm-hmm. Down in Eatonville. Zora.
Coming up, Twitch and Shout. Lowell Handler talks about living with Tourette syndrome. This is Fresh Air. Handler documented the lives of people who live with the condition he has, Tourette syndrome. It's a genetic neurological disorder which creates involuntary movements, noises, and thoughts. Sometimes the symptoms include uncontrollable swearing and obsessive-compulsive behavior. Handler was diagnosed in 1981 when he was 24 years old and in his last year of college studying to be a photographer. After the initial emotional upheaval, Handler decided to deal with his condition by taking pictures. He spent part of 1988 traveling with neurologist Oliver Sacks, photographing people with Tourette syndrome, who Dr. Sacks was writing about. Then he became the associate producer and narrator of a documentary about people with TS called Twitch and Shout. Now he's written a memoir, also called Twitch and Shout. I spoke with him in 1995 when the film was released and asked Handler to describe his symptoms.
I guess I have a lot of different symptoms. I mean, I have a lot of vocal symptoms. I have a lot of noises I make. I have a lot of kind of barking sounds that I make. I have a lot of physical movements, a lot of twisting and turning, a lot of jerky movements of my arms and legs and torso. It's basically, that's what Tourette is. I mean, it's a movement disorder, and it's a disorder that involves an inability to inhibit, and not only to inhibit movement, but also to inhibit thoughts and words and actions and speech and noises and so forth.
What goes through your mind when you go through one of the twitches, like when you stamp your foot or when you thrust your arm out?
Mm-hmm. What goes through my mind?
Yeah. Are you conscious of what's happening, or is it an involuntary?
Well, it's involuntary. Sometimes I can sense it ahead of time, and sometimes it just jumps out. But what goes through my mind isn't any different than what goes through anybody else's mind. There's no particular thought process. There's no,
I guess I'm wondering this. When you're... arm gets thrust out, or when you stamp your foot, are you thinking, I'm going to stamp my foot now, or are you thinking, Oops, I just stamped my foot.
No, neither, really. It just happens. I don't think of myself as really any different than anybody else, except that the only reminder, and it's a constant reminder of how I am different than everybody else, is people's reaction to me. But if there was nobody to react, or, for instance, when I'm around a group of people who've known me for many years, there's no difference at all because they're not reacting, and so I have no mirror.
How much compulsive behavior do you have, and what kind of behavior is that?
The compulsive behavior is one of the most disturbing aspects, I think, of Tourette syndrome. But it's not something that everybody with Tourette has. Certainly, I think a large percentage of people who have Tourette do have it. And that involves, you know, all kinds of things like touching objects, touching people, kicking things, and certain tics or involuntary movements can kind of be, it's kind of difficult sometimes to distinguish what is a tic, an involuntary movement, a manifestation of the Tourette, or what's a sort of compulsive action.
Mm-hmm. Now, I find it interesting. In your movie, you say that a lot of people lose their symptoms when they're absorbed in their work, and that with you too, when you're taking pictures, you're not likely to get, you know, the tics and the noises that can interrupt you during the rest of daily life.
Yeah, that's true.
Is there any explanation for that?
I don't know what the scientific explanation is. I think that I'm not sure, really. I really don't know the answer to that. I know that the symptoms just tend to dissipate when one is involved in an activity and they're really concentrating.
So that must make it very appealing to work a lot.
Yes, I like photographing and I like working, and it keeps me happy.
Well, you know, I interviewed your brother.
Yeah, but am I the first Touretter you've ever interviewed?
Yes, you are.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you are. And I interviewed your brother, I forget if it was a year or two ago, when he was doing... Yeah, your brother Evan Handler, and he was doing a one-person show in New York about the years that he had leukemia. Mm-hmm. But anyways, he had said that, you know, you, his brother... had Tourette's, and so I made the mistake of thinking that you probably cursed a lot involuntarily, which some people with Tourette's do. And so I think I asked your brother if it was unusual to have you visiting and have you kind of cursing involuntarily in the hospital, and he kind of straightened me out and told me that that wasn't a problem that you had, and you straightened me out more in the movie because only 15% of people with Tourette's have this problem, which is called coprolalia.
Right.
But, boy, it must be really hard for that 15% of people with Tourette's who do have it.
Yeah, it's actually very difficult, extremely embarrassing, at times dangerous, and also very funny at times. I have a number of friends who have coprolalia, and especially when a lot of racial slurs are involved. There's one friend I have who lives here in New York City. She actually lives in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And she says a lot of racial slurs. And so whenever we're out together, every single, a member of a given ethnicity will pass by, and she will come out with the racial slur for that particular ethnic group, including her own and mine and anybody else's. So it can be very, very, very interesting going around town with her.
Well, you know, I think some people interpret that as, you know, well, this is what she's really thinking. Somebody else who thought that we would be able to, like, repress it, to keep it in, but because she has this neurological disorder, it comes out. But she really believes these racial epithets.
Well, I think, you know what it is? I'll give you an example that I think people can kind of grasp and understand. Mm-hmm. How many times have you been walking down the street and seen somebody totally bald and thought to yourself, baldy? Or seen somebody who weighs like 400 pounds and thought, fatso? These things pop into everybody's mind, but how many people would actually blurt them out?
But that's my point.
Thinks of the word. Mm-hmm. Sure, she thinks of the word because, you know, a lot of people would think of the word. It doesn't mean that she's against the person or that she's a racist or that she's a bigot at all. But yet the word is in the culture. It's out there. And it's already been established as a sort of label in society. So she simply has the inability to inhibit this language.
Do you remember the first time you met somebody else who had Tourette's?
Yes, I remember that vividly, and it was very frightening for me.
Why was it frightening? I thought you were going to say the opposite.
No, actually, it was frightening because I had, you know, somewhat middle-of-the-road symptoms. And I remember I went to a Tourette Syndrome Association meeting in New York City, which is where I live now. And I went with my parents. And I remember it was very difficult for my parents, too, because here was this thing that you have that... and we really didn't know what to expect. And there was a man there who actually I'm still in touch with, a man named Bob Nast, who lives in New Jersey. And he had some very, he's a very nice guy and he's a very intelligent man. And he had some very kind of classically severe symptoms. And he came over and introduced himself and shook my hand, said hello. And he was like, you know, mouth popping and flailing and all over the place, and I'm saying to myself, holy God, you know, is this going to happen to me, or, you know, what, you know, who knows, you know, Tourette is not degenerative. That's the first thing everybody asks, is it degenerative? It's not degenerative, but it's constantly in a fluctuating state. Sometimes it's worse, sometimes it's better. It waxes and wanes, and it changes every day and every week, and you really don't know what to expect. So it was frightening for me, but then now I don't even give a damn anymore, really. But it just, I didn't know what to expect. It was that kind of thing.
Does anyone on the street ever assume that you're homeless because you're walking funny or because you're talking to yourself?
I think, they don't think I'm homeless because of the way I'm dressed.
Right.
But I think they do think, I've had many times people react where they think I'm an alcoholic or I'm a drug addict. The other day I was in my neighborhood in the East Village, and one of the actually homeless guys who was panhandling, I was buying a New York Times on the corner, and he looked at me, and I was kind of barking and doing that, and he looked at me and said, "You've been drinking that vodka again, huh, buddy?" And I said, "No, have you?" You know, what am I supposed to say? But it's like everybody has some comment. Everybody wants to put in their two cents.
Part of your film is set at a national conference for people with Tourette syndrome.
Tourette's conference.
Yeah, and it looks like a really interesting conference, and several of the people attending comment about how it's the place where they feel most comfortable in the world, mm-hmm. because everyone at the conference has Tourette's and you don't have to explain yourself. The hotel staff understands what's going on. And so you don't have to be self-conscious about anything. Do you feel that way there, too?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And in fact, Oliver Sacks was there with us.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of like our unofficial mascot. it was a lot of fun. I mean, those conferences are incredibly exhausting and rejuvenating at the same time.
There was one discussion at the conference about the difficulty of finding a lover or a spouse. Is it usually hard for people with Tourette's to find somebody that they feel really comfortable with and who feels comfortable with them? I'm wondering, too, if you know a lot of couples who both have the syndrome.
Well, actually, you know, I think it is more difficult for people with Tourette or with any particular condition just because it's an added difficulty. A couple of years ago, both Laurel Chaitin, the director of this film, and myself were at a wedding. And the wedding was two people who both have Tourette syndrome. And it was quite incredible. It really was. Because the man actually had a severe case of Tourette syndrome, and the woman had a mild case of Tourette syndrome. And there was a rabbi conducting the service, and every single thing that was said as part of the ceremony, there was some response by the groom in relation to what was being said, so that the rabbi would say, we all look forward to these things in life, being together, and the things that we look forward to. And the groom yelled out, "Grateful Dead tapes, Grateful Dead tapes." And then he said, we've so thankful to the Tourette Syndrome Association for bringing these people together, and they've given so much. And he said, like, money, money. and you know, all kinds of hysterical things like that. And everything was like a almost like a comedy routine, you know.
When we decided to do this interview, I of course wondered, you know, what if any symptoms would come out while we were talking? You know, would you be twitching as we talked, and you know, would there be noises being made? And now you're in a studio in a separate city from me. We're talking via fiber optic line, so you're in New York, I'm Philadelphia. I haven't seen you, but there's been a couple of times when I heard, I thought a little shout or something.
Right.
But really, I mean, nothing has on the whole sounded different than a typical interview. Do things usually go that uninterrupted for you? Is it because like you're particularly focusing on the interview?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you're disappointed.
No, no.
Actually, it is because I'm sort of focused, but it's also because I think my Tourette is highly visual, and I think that, you know, it also tends to be very interactive, where I'm interacting with other people, so that I'm very animated and I kind of move around a lot. But when I'm kind of concentrated and asked to be contained in a setting, like in a studio like this, in a sound studio or on a train or a bus, I tend to try to keep to myself and just focus on the task at hand, yeah.
Your movie is called Twitch and Shout, which I really like the title because it's funny. And I'm wondering if you and a lot of people you know with Tourette syndrome have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah, we definitely do. I think it's both, you know, it's a full range of things. It's very terrible, it's uncomfortable, it's awful, but it's also quite hysterical and quite funny. And I think it's all of those things at the same time.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Lowell Handler has a new memoir called Twitch and Shout. Our interview was recorded in 1995 after the release of the film Twitch and Shout, which he narrated. Coming up, The Truman Show. This is Fresh Air. Jim Carrey's new movie is a departure from the kind of broad physical comedy that made him rich and famous. Our film critic John Powers has a review of The Truman Show.
The Truman Show is so clever that it takes a while to realize it's not a comedy. Jim Carrey stars as Truman Burbank, a salesman who lives on Sea Haven Island, a beaming community of identically quirky tract houses. He's married to an amiable nurse named Merrill, who's played by Laura Linney, and he drives golf balls off the pier with his lifelong buddy Marlon. It's an idyllic existence until Truman realizes that he's actually the unwitting star of The Truman Show, a 24-hour-a-day TV series that's the ultimate in reality programming. Hidden cameras follow every moment of his life. While Truman himself is real, his loved ones are all actors, his acquaintances extras. And Sea Haven's actually a gigantic domed set overseen by the show's creator, who's played by Ed Harris, who's sort of a cross between Big Brother and God. The movie was written by Andrew Niccol, who made last year's Gattaca, a similar tale of a man rebelling against a manipulative, high-tech society. Here, the hero's existence is a sinister parody of the American dream of security, comfort, and perfect order. Sea Haven Island is a nightmare theme park that cheats Truman of all genuine experience and scripts his life so that even his deepest emotions serve TV ratings. In fact, the movie conjures a voyeuristic, corporate-run America that's only a slight exaggeration of our own, a world where media-fueled fictions overwhelm private lives, as when Truman's frantic attempt to talk honestly with his wife veers into a commercial.
Let me get you some help, Truman. You're not well.
Why do you want to have a baby with me? You can't stand me.
That's not true. Why don't you let me fix you some of this new Mococo drink? All natural cocoa beans from the upper slopes of Mount Nicaragua, no artificial sweeteners.
What the hell are you talking about? Who are you talking to?
I've tasted other cocos. This is the best.
What the hell does this have to do with anything?
The Truman Show is superbly directed by Peter Weir, whose best work, From the Year of Living Dangerously through Fearless, shows us the world in a radically new way. Weir neatly reveals the comic side of Truman's askew reality and does even better at showing how easily we, like Truman, can be manipulated. In the most creepily touching scene, Marlon tries to convince his confused pal Truman that life in Sea Haven is exactly what it seems. The last thing I'd ever do is lie to you, Marlon says, and he speaks the words with such heartfelt conviction that it's hard not to be moved, even though we can see the show's producer feeding him the words on an earphone. Weir even finds a core of restraint in Carrie, he of the eloquent backside. Carrie has said that he'd like to be another Jimmy Stewart, and the character of Truman is a step in that direction. He's terrific in the opening scenes, where he exudes the shallow good cheer you'd expect of a man whose whole life has been designed to make him shallow. But once Truman starts seeing the truth, Carrie lacks the emotional weight to make us feel Truman's inner turmoil. Like many comedians turned actors, he seems scooped out, and I kept wishing the movie could have starred the real James Stewart. At bottom, The Truman Show is an ingenious allegory about a man who risks everything he's known to escape a reality that he's been raised to accept without question. His story has been worked out so cleverly that I only wish it didn't leave me so cold. Watching, I kept thinking about the old movie It's a Wonderful Life, whose hero George Bailey yearns to flee the small town where he's always lived, but remains tethered to it by love for his neighbors and family, especially his warm-hearted wife. George is torn by an ambivalence that borders on hysteria. Truman faces no such inner conflict. Why would he want to stay with his wife, an actress whose pretense at love is little more than a form of cheerful castration? Why should he feel any ties to his hometown, a fake community whose citizens are as hollow as holograms? In attempting to flee Sea Haven, Truman doesn't have to struggle with loyalty or love, only the logistics of getting away. And the result is a climax that must disguise its emotional tinniness with lazy, feel-good imagery. The Truman Show wants us, like its hero, to question our own prefab reality. But like most allegories, it finally makes things far too easy. Truman Burbank is faced with a scary but simple choice, freedom or captivity, rather than having to choose among different forms of freedom and captivity, which is what the rest of us must do every day.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salla, Naomi Person, and Kathy Wolf, with Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Anne-Marie Boldenato. Alan Tu and Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, Armistead Maupin talks about more tales of the city. His novel about life and love, Straight and Gay, set in San Francisco in the 70s, has been adapted into a Showtime miniseries. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.